Welcome back to the Up North podcast. I'm Sarah Yacoub.
And I'm Kirk Bankstead.
And I'm Pat Kreitlow. And we come to you live on Wednesdays as a podcast on the weekends. Our radio hosts at News Talk 92.7 have shows throughout the week. It can be heard anywhere in Wisconsin or elsewhere on planet Earth, thanks to the Double Radio app. And as a podcast, you can catch us weekends on our website, upnorthpodcast.com, and all the usual places where you can subscribe and listen to us. This show is not affiliated with where you find me in my day job, despite the similar name, but you can go to upnorthnewswi.com or upnorthnewswi on social media and get fully up to speed on the day's news and top issues. So now it's time for us to get to why the Kyle Rittenhouse trial should matter to folks up north, frankly, nationwide, if you care about the courts and a fair court system, but you know why it should matter. And so Kirk's going to introduce our first guest.
Yeah, so my thought was this, you know, Wisconsin is now, it's a center of attention with this Kyle Rittenhouse trial. The trial is about a minor having a semi-automatic weapon entering the melee of a race riot and shooting and killing people. And we're at the center of attention nationwide, but this is happening down south. And I thought it would be so great. And I just happened to know Louis Malepsky, who's the district attorney of Portage County. We grew up in Stevens Point together. We ran cross country together when we were kids. And I was like, how cool would it be if Louis could actually kind of give us his, you know, perceptions of what it means to be a DA, what it means to have to kind of try a case like this.
Just know it from the standpoint of a district attorney. Louis and I also both served together in the legislature back in 2007, 2008, something like that, before he became, you know, a big deal in Portage County service.
He is a big deal. But I also know that being a friend of Louis, I don't want to get him in the hot water. And I know that being a DA, an active DA, I want to just have Louis. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this, first and foremost. But then, can you tell us what you're able and not able to talk about here, so our audience kind of understands where some of the guardrails are, because you are an acting DA.
Sure, and I appreciate the invite to the show. And Pat, it's good to see you again. Going down memory road there, but you know, this is an open case. It's active. I represent the state of Wisconsin along with the prosecutors. We're on the same team, so to speak. And I'm not going to be commenting on, you know, the choice of the charges or anything about the evidence at this time, you know, really because the jury's deliberating. And even though the jury's not supposed to be listening to this podcast, maybe they are. And let's hope that they follow the judge's instructions. As far as the judge, I know the judge has gotten some critique in the media for and against, and I'd rather not go too much into hard critique of the judge, as I really don't think that's appropriate.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Louis. And so I think we should give the floor to our actual past deputy district attorney from LA County, who's got a lot of questions for you. But I guess the first thing is, can you just talk to us as a DA, what are your ultimate goal? Like, if you had to try a case like this, what do you have to do? You have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in order to get a conviction. Can you just walk us through the basic steps of the underlying trial and what a district attorney needs to actually accomplish in the case?
Well, I had a trial, somewhat like the Rittenhouse case. There's a decedent, and ultimately the defendant is claiming self-defense. That's something that in Wisconsin we call a privilege. When that's evoked, ultimately the burden is placed upon the state to prove a negative. In other words, that the defendant that their actual or imminent unlawful interference was not actually there. That the defendant believed that the amount of force was reasonable. You try to basically show that was not reasonable in light of the circumstances. I had a case that's now been, the person's been convicted of life in prison. He indicated that he needed to shoot the victim, who was about 6 feet away, because he took a minor step toward him, possessing no weapon. The defendant was behind a vehicle, like cover, with a firearm. and shot him in front of his two minor children. And there, that the jury found that that was not a proper use of self-defense, and in fact, the defendant, if anybody, had lost that right of self-defense, and even if the jury had found it, had provoked, really was provoking the situation by being there. Ultimately, he was interfering in the decedent's new relationship with his ex-wife. So these are very fact-specific type of analyses, and Sarah, I'm sure in her experience, has had similar cases. The laws are similar across the United States, but I'll say one thing for your listeners: when we talk about self-defense, and if there's an area where we want to change policy, that's really where you look at. It's a very broad definition of self-defense and the right to use deadly force.
Well, and one of the things that strikes me so interesting in California, when we were making filing decisions, the idea of mutual combat or self-defense seem very much up front in the filing decisions. So not speaking about any case in particular, if you could help our audience understand, is that something that comes into account at filing, or is that something you figure, okay, the defense is going to raise at trial, but we will proceed as though self-defense is not a valid explanation for what is going on here?
Well, Sarah, sometimes you're lucky enough to know the defense from the get-go. But in my case, that was not raised until the jury trial.
Interesting.
Because the defendant in my case had made a partial admission. So we figured the defendant probably would take the stand because the evidence was so strong, but we didn't expect, really until they requested the instruction, was that they were going to claim self-defense. Whether it was a perfect or imperfect self-defense type of scenario. And that was interesting. Because one thing you cannot do, you can't say, well, this is the first time we're hearing about this, because it really gets into the area of the defendant's silence where he did not make statements about a certain aspect of it, which is his right not to. So that's a balancing for the prosecutor. Sometimes it seems, well, you know, of course you're going to talk about it. Well, you got to be careful.
Well, and, you know, you bring up an interesting point with Doyle error, which for our friends at home is a DA or a prosecutor doing what Louis just said, commenting on someone exercising their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination or their silence. But Louis, you know, what do you think, or, you know, I imagine there's cases on point, none are coming to mind, but before someone is Mirandized, so after the crime has happened or after the incident has happened, the jury decides if it's a crime, and the person's making statements or the person's not making statements, is that all fair game up until someone is Mirandized and elects to maintain silence?
So how I prosecute the case is pre-invocation of the right, I will get into that if I believe it's necessary. But usually I don't bring up the discussions of the defendant unless there's a clear compelling reason to, because I want to force the defendant onto the stand. I want that defendant to be subject to cross-examination, because more likely than not, they're going to slip up and say something that, like I just had a first-degree sexual assault trial where they said something that we had never heard before, and where we knew that the victim had been severely injured, claimed, well, I didn't do that, but I did everything else. So there, it was a great point for cross-examination. But before they invoke that right to silence, you can get into that. But once they invoke, you're not supposed to be getting into why they didn't say something, because they don't have to be a witness against them. That's a constitutional protection.
The whole point of, you know, Miranda is that anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. But then there's times when the defendant does not have to take the stand in something like this. Kyle Rittenhouse did put on a performance that has been judged, you know, one way or the other, depending on your feelings. And even on this Wednesday, as this case is being, or as the show is being taped, in the case of the men who, you know, shot down Ahmaud Arbery, you had one of the defendants surprisingly take the stand in his own defense. So, Louis, I wanted to ask you about that. Is it, you know, whether You as a prosecutor don't have to make this decision, but to what degree are you surprised or not surprised when you see a defendant decide to take the stand, you know, especially in a case that's rather high profile?
Well, it's always, it's only the defendant's right, or he or she has the ability to stand, get on the stand or get off the stand. No one can force them onto the stand, not their attorney, not the prosecutor, judge. If they get on the stand, then it's really fair game on fair questions to that defendant on a wide variety of things. I like to really get a narrative, talk about timelines, and really get into when their timeline is inconsistent with the witness's testimony prior to them getting on the stand in the defense case. Because the jury really can see where there's holes, where they're not talking about something, and then we try to go into that area. You know, when the defendant does take the stand, though, sometimes it's against counsel's advice. Their attorney is saying, do not take the stand. This is not going to go well for you. And a lot of times...
Right. And aren't you, when that happens, do you as the prosecutor kind of look at that as he or she is walking to the stand and going, really? You're going to do that? Okay, well, you're game on.
Well, I had a defendant who, on a child pornography, largest pornographer in our county's history, a million images, videos, he wanted to show everybody he was the smartest person in the room and that his wife was the person who did all this. Well, the thing about it was what he didn't know was he wasn't the smartest person in the room. It was actually the DOJ analyst who taught him a few things about computer forensics, and I used that against him. And you know, I'll say this, you know, we don't get giddy when we make points, but when the defendant used the certain middle finger, you know, right in front of the jury at me, I felt good because I had made a point and he tried to make a point, but the jury knew that was a bunch of hogwash.
There you go.
All right. So I wanted to take it kind of I love all this legalese. And it's very kind of really cool to hear people in the profession kind of talk about how they go, like the strategy of winning a case. But I wanted to take it up a notch for our listeners. Can you tell us, Louis, what the ultimate goal is for this Rittenhouse trial, the DA's goal? What are they trying to accomplish? I think that's just, you know, fact, but I want us to get all on the same page. And then if that happens or doesn't happen, what are the repercussions for Wisconsin? You've been an assemblyman, you know, what, and you know, you love your state. What are the repercussions for Wisconsin, whether or not this goes one way or the other way?
Well, the state filed its charges in Kenosha. That was after their consideration of the evidence, and they've presented their case to a jury of the defendant's peers. And clearly they are seeking convictions, otherwise they wouldn't have filed the charges. And ultimately they're looking to hold the defendant accountable for those particular charges. Ultimately at the end of this case, what I hope to come out of it is that one, there's no violence, obviously, on either side of the issue, however you agree or disagree with the filing or Rittenhouse or Mr. Blake. But I hope that the legislature and the people in northern Wisconsin really understand that the power of self-defense and the power that the legislature has given the average person and law enforcement is great. And ultimately, the use of deadly force in a particular fact pattern, that power actually, unbeknownst to most people, you have great power. And if you use that power, I hope it's used properly. But ultimately, it is very difficult to prove someone guilty of a particular offense once self-defense is raised. It reverts to the state to prove a negative, that they didn't use it reasonably.
So you brought up something interesting, and I had my brother-in-law come up to me and say, you know, why are people giddy that these things are happening? And it made me think about how we talk about these cases, and that we're not giddy that there's an injustice, but if there is going to be an injustice or a crime or a tragedy, that the truth comes to light or that justice comes to light. So I just want our listeners out there to hear, when you say that we're giddy, it's this feeling of righting a wrong, providing justice to the community, not, you know, DAs who are celebrating you know, evil. Cause that's it, people who aren't in this world are like, well, why are you happy? Like, well, you know, we work hard to provide justice to the community. And it's exciting when that actually happens and things can get a little bit better for the victims, the survivors. And the
right. And let's not forget, and not going too far in Rittenhouse, but remember, there are two decedents. There are two people that are dead, and their family members have lost their loved ones. There's also a person that was shot. There's and for that person, a lifelong that trauma is going to remain. And also for the defendant, the trauma there of taking lives and putting himself in that situation of coming to Kenosha with a high-powered AR-15. So at the end of the day, justice is trying to make sure that this doesn't happen again. You know, because even in northern Wisconsin, I remember as a kid, I mean, we got really upset at boat landings when people were just fishing for walleyes and right. people's lives were threatened. And I don't remember if anybody was killed, but, you know, it's right now we have a lot of hypersensitivity on politics and many different issues. I mean, I have people threatening school board members about
right.
you know, making policy. So people yep. should take one thing away, which is this is real. If you take someone's life, you should be with the full eyes that, you know, you may be prosecuted and have to defend Sounds yourself.
Good. Louis, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time. It was great to see you again, and thanks yeah. for your insight.
Thank you very much, Pat, Kirk, Sarah.
Right. We'll have more after this. You're up north.
All right. Louis.